Miranda Rappard, Reel 12. We're talking about various incidents and stories that happened during visits ashore in Gibraltar and then later North Africa. And you had one story you wanted to tell about a particular sailor. If you want to start with that.
Yes, the particular sailor I had in mind, who happened to be a Liverpool Irishman, was a man who had difficulty holding his drink. And occasionally he'd been in trouble already for one reason or another as a result of it. Unfortunately, he made a habit of committing his offences when I happened to be the duty officer. And it was quite accidental, coincidental that this happened, but nevertheless it did. So in his somewhat befuddled mind, he became quite certain that he was in trouble because I had it in for him in some way, whereas the last thing I wanted was to have the problem of dealing with a chap who was in that state. But when we were in Algiers, the time had come when he was fed up with the Navy and fed up with discipline and fed up with everything. We were secured alongside, and he had broken out of the ship when he wasn't meant to and had disappeared. And, of course, he chose to come back when I was on duty at night, but supper time, dusk. And when he came back, he seemed to be reasonably upright. He wasn't reeling about, and although he'd obviously had some drink, it wasn't too serious. So I arranged that the coxswain, who was the senior disciplinary rating on the ship, should come along and charge him with breaking out of the ship and being absent without leave, which was what had actually happened, the nuts and bolts case. And there was no mention of drink at that time. So the defaulter's table was set up just by the brow on the iron deck. At the bottom of the brow, there was an armed sentry, because we were at war, weren't we? And the man was duly brought up in front of me and charged with absence without leave and breaking out of the ship. So I asked him whether he'd got anything to say, and he was totally silent. So I said to him again, "What have you got to say about this? Do you understand the charge?" And so he just looked at me straight in the face, and then without giving any other indication that he was going to do it, he turned sideways and swung his left fist with great violence into the stomach of the coxswain, who wasn't expecting it, standing virtually beside him. Luckily, I was behind the desk at the time. The coxswain doubled up and fell onto the deck, saying, "Oof!" And the man turned round and belted down the brow towards the jetty. So I yelled out to the sentry, and the sentry turned round just in time to get this chap's boot under his chin. So I was on the iron deck with the coxswain at my feet and the sentry on lying down at the bottom of the jetty, the man running off towards the gate, which was about 150 yards away, out of the dockyard. And it struck me that we ought to save the man from himself, because he was bound to commit more horrors if he was in that state. And I reckoned that if I could get within shouting distance of the gate, I could tell them to stop him, because there were more sentries of some sort, army or whatever, on the gate. So I had a torch, and I ran after the chap to the gate, which was great. But halfway around, he turned and started to chase me, so we ran away from the gate. And this toing and froing occurred two or three times. But when I was running away from him, I turned the torch out in the hope that he wouldn't know where I was going. When I was running after him, I kept the torch on him so I would know where he was going. But on one of the occasions when I was being chased, I fell over a pile of stones I hadn't seen because I hadn't got the torch on, and he caught me. Well, one of the basic rules for an officer is never let a drunken man catch you. So I was wrong in that case, but in the circumstances, I was much more concerned with saving my life, because he set about me with every intention of gouging my eyes out or strangling me or both. I felt perhaps his confusion about which was the more important perhaps saved me. But I was becoming slightly unconscious because he had his hands round my throat and he'd tried gouging my eyes with his thumbs. And however much I kicked him, he was lying in such a way that I couldn't do any damage that way. However, my arm stretched out. I found a fairly large stone under one hand, and so I brought it over and hit him on the head as hard as I could with the stone, and it knocked him out. It also split his scalp so that I could feel the blood dripping down onto me underneath. And at about that time, and I was a bit uncertain about the sequence of events just then. He was pulled off me by a team led by the coxswain, who'd come over from the ship to, in fact, see that all was well. It wasn't. So they dealt with the man, and I ordered that he should be put in a Neil Robertson stretcher, which is a bamboo stretcher with canvas in between, designed to immobilize casualties, and you can be strapped into it, but you can't get out of it unless somebody helps you. That he should be put in one of these stretchers and lowered down into the capstan flat, and that his messmate should sit as sentry duty alongside him to see that he didn't die of swallowing his own vomit or something. Well, I went back to the ship. Well, I was dressed in long uniform blue trousers in the usual way, serge trousers, and an open neck white shirt, which was a sort of Red Sea rig we wore for supper. And it was about dinner time, and I knew that dinner would be starting in the wardroom. So I thought, with such a ghastly offence having been committed, I'd better go back to the wardroom and say so. So I made my way down aft and went into the wardroom with my shirt ripped right down to my trouser level and blood dripping everywhere, both mine and his. And I saw the captain there. And I drew breath to say, "Excuse me, sir, aye," and I got about that far. And he said, "You're disgusting, sir, get out." I said, "But sir, don't bloody butt me." He said, "Get out. Go and tidy yourself up." "Aye, aye, sir," is the answer to that. So I went off to my cabin and I had a wash and I cleaned myself up, changed my clothes and so on. And I came back into the wardroom and went up to the captain and said, "Excuse me, sir, I'm sorry I've kept up." He said, "We're waiting for you." I said, "Yes, well, I just tell you, I'm not asking your advice, son," he said. "What would you like to drink? Have a drink." "Oh, no, I've been a bit late." I said, "Don't quibble," he said. "Have a drink." So I took his advice and had a drink. And when I'd had the drink, he said, "What's happened?" So I told him what had happened. He said, "Where did you put him?" And I said, "Down the capstan flat." "Right, we'll have dinner," he said. So we had dinner. And the man was given 90 days detention up in the army detention quarters, and because it was out of the ship, somewhere up in the hills south of Algiers, sighs of relief all round. Unfortunately, two things went wrong. Firstly, the army detention quarters wasn't a patch on the naval detention quarters that I knew about in Portsmouth, and they'd made him the sergeant's messman up there as opposed to giving him a hard time. And the second thing that went wrong, he was sent back to the same ship. So I was horrified to find that he'd come back on board Tartar about 3 or 4 months later. He then had a birthday when we happened to be at sea, and he persuaded some of his messmates to give him sippers for their grog ration. So once more he lost his temper and control and everything else. I happened to be the duty officer again. And a message came to me that he'd gone fighting mad on the mess deck and two or three of his messmates were laid out and he was roaring like a bull and, "Ooh, sir, what should we do," in effect. So I went down to have a look and found that they'd reported it accurately and that this chap was rampaging like a bull of Bashan, shouting at anybody who came within sight. I wondered what to do. Looking down the hatch, only one or two people at the most could go down there together, and he was going to knock them off as they came to the bottom of the hatch. And there weren't many people among the duty hands that I'd got there, and the coxswain again, who wanted to do that. So I had one of the duty hands stand behind the armoured hatch and take the catch off, and I went down the ladder myself until he came roaring to attack me, and I went up the ladder pretty sharpish, and the hatch just wasn't fixed and dropped on him. So the poor fellow had a cracked skull and was eventually invalided out of the service. I learned an awful lot about this, but the ship's company reckoned I'd done absolutely the right thing. The captain fortunately did too, because that would have been very awful if he hadn't. But these things happened.
Now, you have a couple more stories about characters on the ship, and if you'd like to...
Yes, I have got a couple. They're very human stories, in a way. one has to appreciate that the cabins in the tribal class destroyers were much more luxurious than anything the older fashion destroyers had. So I had hot and cold running water in my cabin, which was amazing. And as sub-lieutenant, I had a desk and a bunk and all the places to stow my gear. I wasn't in the wardroom flat. I was the next flat forward there, the other side of away from one of the bulkheads there. And the man who was told off to look after my affairs and be my servant was an ordinary seaman called Logie. Now, Logie was very Scots indeed. I think he'd been conscripted. His job had been as body servant, I think, to the Laird of Drummond Castle in Scotland. It wasn't quite clear to me what that meant at the time, but he dealt with my clothes and looked after my cabin, and became not so much a friend, but he became able to talk to me, which was interesting because it transpired that he'd had very little education, not his fault in any way, and eventually that he had difficulty reading the letters he got from home. And he gave me the great compliment of bringing those letters to me to read to him. And so although I was young and he was 12, 14 years older than me, I found that the letters from his wife dealt in, and indeed his young daughter, dealt with matters of an intimacy I hadn't come across in my own life at all before. And it was really marvelous to be able to help the chap in that way. And I relied on him. Well, he happened to be amongst, be down in that flat when something unpleasant happened to me. The engineer officer came down to me in the ship and attacked me in the sense that it was clear he thought I was homosexual, which I not only wasn't, but I had a great horror of it. And in the end, I had to dissuade him violently. And it was only when I grabbed him by the hair and banged his head on the steel deck that he desisted and picked himself up and said, "I'm terribly sorry, thought you'd enjoy it." Now, Logie, to the best of my knowledge, never told anybody else in the ship about that incident, even though he had some idea that it had happened, if he hadn't actually witnessed part of it or heard part of it. And I felt very much supported by Logie because under stress in the events happening in the ship, I did start getting nightmares in that ship, and indeed often found myself in the middle of the night running up the iron deck and climbing up to my action station because I dreamt that the alarm bells had gone. Again, Logie didn't talk about that on the mess decks, I'm virtually certain, because it never came back to me at all, and I think it would have done. I was very impressed by the loyalty of Logie. And indeed, in a subsequent ship, I'd mentioned another man who was my servant, who was also very loyal.
Now, these nightmares, that's actually led us on to how were you feeling it in yourself at the time? Because was it all suppressed to the nighttime nightmares, or were you getting more and more nervous in the day? So, you know, went away.
Yes, I know what you mean. I don't think nervous in the day describes it, because there was a job to do, and we were watchkeeping. And whenever we were east of Algiers, we tended to go into two watches, that's watch on, watch off. And we were dawn and dusk action stations as well. It meant there wasn't much sleep. And every now and then you went to action stations when perhaps you were previously at defense station because there was an attack of some sort. So the stress was partly due to a broken sleep or lack of it, partly due to the fact that we knew that there were, the enemy was around, and some of the ships we knew quite well had been hit, and we knew about people being killed and so on, because it was war, wasn't it? And we also became increasingly aware that the tribal class destroyers were being sunk all over the place, particularly down in the other end of the Med, where there'd been a number of casualties from people we knew. So before I left Tata, which is jumping ahead about 6-9 months, before I left Tata, she was the only one of the tribals left afloat and running. There were three others afloat out of the 16 we'd started the war with. And therefore, we were not only the maid of all work, we were at the front end of it, the sharp end of the work, for various things which I'll talk about later on when it came to invasion. So far, we've only been a close support and interdiction, having done two major convoys, of course, beforehand. But there was more to come.
Okay, so we'll monitor that as it goes on. After this period, when you were back with the main fleet, you went back to Bone, and it says in your letter that the job had changed because you were now able to occupy your positions during the day as well, because you had fighter cover. In other words, the army was moving up the coast, I suspect.
Yes, this was interesting in one sense, because although we were fighting a war at sea, it was very much a three-service business. And the impact of success on shore by the soldiers, and indeed the availability of air cover at a point in the Med where we could never have it before from the shore, did make our operations possible and day and night. And quite clearly, though, it was very important indeed to reduce the possibility of the Germans escaping from North Africa when the war was coming to an end there. When we got round to the business of the Germans trying to do a Dunkirk from North Africa, although we were frightened of being torpedoed by submarines or attacked by E-boats while this was happening, there was a sense of achievement, a sense of success with it as well. And the feeling, therefore, was upbeat. We were actually winning part of the war for once, as opposed to being on our back feet, which we'd felt for a long time. And I think that this improved our morale, or kept it up, even though we were getting tighter and tighter, and the ship was wearing out, because we'd had so many near misses and so on, and we knew that the next stage of the proceedings was bound to be invasions.
Now, the next thing is the Pantelleria actions.
Yes, as soon as the boating week was over, when the Germans were trying to escape, geography showed that the next obstacle before one could start moving into Sicily, if that was the naval plan, which of course we didn't know, was the island of Pantelleria itself, which was held by the Italians. It was in sight, this island, most of the time when we were off Cape Bon, and indeed the Italians there could always see what was going past them, and so it was a reporting station on us. Whenever we came anywhere near them, however, it seemed that the Italians, we felt at the time, were displaying a sort of perspiring nervousness, because they put smoke floats or smoke clouds over some of their positions. What on earth we'd be looking for, I'm not quite sure, but nevertheless, that was their reaction. And I believe that by the time we actually invaded the place, they'd probably used up all their smoke, because we didn't see it when the time came to invade them. But that time did come, and Tata was in the forefront in the sense of having the force commander on board, and also of being involved in the bombardment itself. Clearly, the problem was going to come from some batteries which were dug in behind the beach, where we knew our chaps had to go ashore. So we were lining up on that and firing. I was firing broadsides at it when I found the range. What I didn't know was that the American Strategic Air Force had been also booked to do something here, and we saw a number of either liberators or fortresses, I think they were fortresses, coming up in formation as the boats, the landing craft, were actually moving towards the beach. They were about half a mile out still, maybe, when the Patton bombs from these fortresses hit the beach, and the whole beach just rose into the air, and so did the guns behind it. And so when the landing craft hit the beach, there was certainly no gun opposition, and I was too far out to know if there were any rifles or machine guns, but I didn't think there were. So very, very quickly, the island of Pantelleria surrendered. And I think probably an awful lot of the huge destruction had, in fact, knocked all the stuffing out of the defenders. I'd been firing at one particular battery ashore just before the bombers dropped their bombs. And I could see that I'd hit it and that nobody was firing back from it anymore anyway. So I shifted to the house alongside the battery, which I thought was probably the battery mess. I'm happy to say that it raised its roof politely and fell flat as a result of the fire right away. Certainly the guns ashore didn't start firing again until we turned away, and they didn't do too badly then, even though they actually hit nothing. We'd been trying to find out what was happening at Pantelleria actually just before the invasion itself, and that's when I was involved in shooting that time round. When we went back with the others, then the bombers did most of the work. We were left with the commander of the operation on board still, as the only ship remaining off the beaches. We weren't anchored or anything like that, but we were stopped. And the sun was down in the west somewhere when we were jumped by a Focke-Wulf 190. It came out of the sun. We hadn't had a radar warning of it at all. And the first thing I saw was this thing diving at us from astern, but I was looking at it through the funnel smoke, and I couldn't get the main weapons onto it by the control I was exercising from the director. But I did expect that the short-range weapons, the Oerlikons, would fire. But the one which I expected to open fire didn't do anything, even though I'd said open fire. And the bomb that dropped rather wetted us considerably. It was only about 30 feet off again, 30 or 40 feet off, the huge cloud of spray and muck in it. And so we then set about finding out why on earth the Oerlikon hadn't fired. And we found that it hadn't got a gunner anymore. And he wasn't anywhere in sight, so he hadn't been hit by anything. We found him down in the bowels of the ship, scared out of his wits and holding on to the largest piece of steel he could find, which in fact was the quickest way of being drowned in a ship if you go right down to the bottom of it. But as sometimes happened to people, he'd lost his cool completely. And just as the young baronet had when I was in Sheffield and a midshipman, he'd lost his cool and run for it. There is nowhere to run, but it does happen that people lose all control.
Well, was he punished?
I can't remember. I think he was probably sent ashore to rest or something. There were ships who treated this, if you caught it at the time, during an action, you might shoot somebody. But in these circumstances, that would have been inappropriate. And I think we were dealing with a chap whose nerve had gone.
Now, the next day, there was another raid by six Focke-Wulf 190s. It seems to have been immediately following on the next day. Do you recall that at all?
Next day, quite clearly, the Germans in Sicily were reacting really rather more strongly than they had done when we were doing the landings in Pantelleria. Some six Focke-Wulf 190s dive-bombed us out of the sun, and again I got wet from the bomb splashes. And one very keen German attacked a group of landing craft tanks who were taking about 4,000 Italians away as prisoners. And a whole heap of them abandoned ship, jumped over the side in terror. I sympathize with that, but in fact, if you're in the water when the bomb goes off, you'll get more damage to you than otherwise.
Would you help pick them up again, or...?
No, there were enough LCTs to do it. The LCTs weren't, in fact, hit.
Now, after that, you went back to Malta, and you went to a rest camp for 48 hours.
That was a great joy to me, because I really did need the sleep and need a complete rest. It was on a quiet part of the island, away from the Valletta, and it was part of a hospital. And quite clearly, the hospital wasn't fully occupied at the time, so it was awaiting casualties, I suppose, from the invasions to come. That's guesswork. I was given a very quiet time indeed, and charming girls looked after the nurses and so on, looked after me. And I went swimming, and I did all the things one would long to do, and I didn't say anything about the Navy, and nobody attacked us for a whole 48 hours, which was absolutely blissful. And I think that it helped. They probably gave me something to help me sleep. I can't remember that, but I do remember sleeping jolly well. The juicy figs, which were just about ripe for picking, stayed in my mind, as did the prickly pears. Something I felt very warm about at the time and got sunburned and had time to be sunburned as opposed to always rushing off to do something else. It was a prelude, in fact, to the invasion of Sicily.
Now, there's two aspects of the preparations of this. One is that it seems to have almost caught you by surprise, according to the letter. People weren't expecting it. And the second thing is that, rather interestingly, you attended the commanding officers' conference just before sailing. So if you could comment on why you were caught by surprise first. I mean, because that's quite interesting, the way that, even though you're in the Navy, you didn't seem to know it was happening.
No, I think the frontline destroyers working in the Narrows and doing what we'd been doing in Pantelleria and so on, lived very much day to day. We weren't looking at the next operation. We were waiting to receive orders to do whatever it was. I think had one sat back and considered strategy and all those other things, it would have been obvious in the naval sense that if we were going anywhere, we had to do that. But we had, one must remember, been on our back foot for so long that apart from the landings in North Africa themselves and then the success ashore of the army there, we hadn't done anything but be on the defensive. And when you're at sea and expecting to be attacked all the time because you're protecting something, you're thinking about the little battle you're fighting rather than the next strategic move. Certainly from a young officer, and I was still very young this time. Therefore, when we I saw there were a mass of ships at Malta, we weren't being bombed in Malta, which was also interesting. But I knew that Malta had been rescued by the pedestal of convoy not all that long before. And so it just seemed, when the orders arrived, oh, well, that's the next thing we're going to do. We hadn't actually anticipated it. Perhaps we should have done, but I hadn't anyway.
Now, you attended the commanding officers' conference with the Admiral just before sailing. Why did you attend it, and what do you remember of it?
Well, I attended because my captain told me to. What I remember of it was that I was one of the most junior people there, and that the emphasis was on cooperation with all the other forces. And the Admiral commanding the convoys and commanding the naval forces had obviously got his information straight with his army and RAF colleagues. And what we were being told was that it was our duty to make certain that those landing craft got ashore, and that the first thing that would happen is that the convoys were actually sailing up past Libya as he was talking. They were on their way from the Eastern Med.
Who was the Admiral?
I don't remember who it was, no. Certainly, I had a much deeper insight of what the whole picture was, having listened to that. And it affected very much my thinking about the operations, I think, as they unfolded in the next few days. Clearly, we hadn't been given much warning because there was a security risk if we had been told too soon.